overflowing with love. I am overflowing with happiness. I am filled with the power to make a change. You create a brand new life. I am.
Welcome to the podcast of the Sunday Celebration from the Center of Spiritual Living in Huntsville, Alabama. We hope you feel the grace, the beauty, and the love of our community as you hear the message of the week. Have a beautiful week.
Thank you, guys. Oh, it's so good to see everybody here. Someone came up to me earlier this Sunday and wanted to talk about the coronavirus. And you know, I said, this isn't probably a good time for me because it's right before the church service. I remember one Sunday, someone wanted to talk about their dying grandmother right before the church service. And I said, can we talk about your dying grandmother after the service? Because it's, but you know what I do want to say about fear is I was around in the 80s when the AIDS crisis hit Atlanta. And I can't count the number of young men that died in my arms. And at that time, there was this fear around AIDS. And there was this fear that you couldn't touch them, because if you touched them, if you held them, you might catch the virus. I got in the bed with them, and I held them in my arms. I went beyond that belief system. I was working as a waiter at the time, as a gay man, and I remember people thinking, if I go to a barbecue with a gay person and a mosquito bites the gay person and then bites me, I could die of the AIDS crisis. So I saw a fear that was so rampant at that time that I said, I'm not going to go down the path of fear. We're going to Circle of Love at the end of this month, and I'm wondering, do I need to wear a mask on the airplane as I go to California? And I, you know what? I'm not going to stop hugging you. I'm not going to stop kissing you. If you're afraid of me, you can put your arms out, and I will respect that. And if you should come with a mask on, I will honor that too. But I do know the power of fear, and I don't want to go down that path. I remember when I first moved to Alabama, the landlord, Ben Stevens, at the other place, he says, you should be glad they don't burn a cross down there at the front of your church. I thought, what is he trying to scare me, that they're going to burn a cross at the front of my church just because I'm a Religious Science church? I didn't go down that path either. I wasn't going to buy into that fear mentality. So I've been here 30 years. We're still alive. We haven't had any crosses, and I haven't, well, I'm knock on wood. Where, you know, I'm a little superstitious sometimes. Yeah, so this is an unorthodox teaching, and little Ashley knows that because she stepped out of the nest of an evangelical religion. Anybody resemble that besides, okay. And, you know, I was thinking of you, Ashley, this morning when Adam was out talking to the crow. You know, the eagles, when they make their nest, and if you go to Northern California and up into Canada, where I did the Circle of Love, we would see the bald eagles. They're everywhere. And the bald eagles, they're in their nests, and they're huge nests. But they make them specifically uncomfortable for the little fledglings. And when the fledglings get older, the nest is uncomfortable. It's like they have thorns in the nest. So that when the nest becomes uncomfortable, then the parent eagle kind of pushes them off the edge of the nest and says, go, be free. Now, what if you and I have to step out of the nest of our belief systems? Maybe those religions that are too confining and too contracting, in order to find a spirituality that's all-embracing. You know, Ashley reminded me there's this old idea of God out there in the sky. And in our teaching, we recognize that the only God you'll ever experience is the God within yourself. So this is what we call panentheism. All there is God, but God is within everything. That's a huge realization. Then you can talk about oneness, as Ernest Holmes did. He said, one, one, one. If we teach anything, we teach oneness. So there's only one here. There's only one life, and we're all an aspect of that life. And then there's this compassion that can flow. So if I'm judging other, I'm really judging my own self. So that's why Jesus, in his wisdom, he was an awakened soul. He said, love your enemy. He says, do good to those that harm you, because they all are you. So we're called to a higher order of discovery here at the Center for Spiritual Living. And after 30 years, I find that it gets richer and deeper and more mysterious with every class that I teach, with every Sunday that I speak. And so I was kind of observing myself for this month. I'm talking about the mystery of life itself. To think of life as the great mystery, that the universe is this great mystery, and it wants us to take us into itself so that as Seamus is coming, he's being worked on by the universe, he says, I don't have a clue. That's because the local mind that was once in control, that was trying to fix everything, is not in control. You have a new director in your life, and it's the universe. So the universe is calling, are we really listening? You know, Joanne reminded me that she is in this beautiful space of silence. And Eckhart Tolle says silence is the language of God. He said everything else is a poor translation. So could we listen to the sounds of silence? Could we hear? And then ask the question, what is listening? What is hearing? There's something really deep. I'm thinking of already the class for spring is ready, and I'm thinking of the class for summer. And I was reading Don Miguel Ruiz's son, Jose, has written a book called The Wisdom of the Shamans. And as I was reading that yesterday, he said in the Toltec tradition, Toltec means artist. And he says, we're all the artist of spirit. We're all creating our own life with everything we do. And then I pull out my Anam Cara, and John O'Donohue from the Celtic tradition says the same thing. We're all artists of the mind. And when we know that we're not just accessing the local controlling fix-it mind, but we're accessing the infinite creative mind that is ever evolving more into itself, that's where Seamus is writing his book. And I said, now the trick with that, Seamus, is you're not the writer. And he smiled at me and he says, of course, I am the conduit through which spirit writes its music. So on the very first page of the Anam Cara, my old book that I've taught so many times, it's been underlined and circled, and the very first thing he says is, the mystery never leaves you alone, and how strange it is to be here. The mystery never leaves you alone. It's working on you. And so just give you a taste of how he addresses the mystery. He says, we listen to things, but we never hear them. True listening brings us in touch even with that which is unsaid and that which is unsayable. True listening is listening to that still small voice that's within. So he says, sometimes the most important threshold of mystery are the places of silence. I love it when Glory G got up here and said, so let's just take a moment to enter into the silence. A silence that is deafening sometimes, even when your thoughts go crazy. He says, to be genuinely spiritual is to have a great respect for the possibilities and presence of silence. That's why some of us have to go off into the forest and commune with nature, because we're talking, we're listening to the very presence that's all around us and seeking our attention. He says, Martin Heidegger says this. He says, true listening is worship. He says, when you listen with your soul, you come into rhythm with unity, with the music of the universe, and through friendship and love, you learn to attune yourself to the silence, to the thresholds of the mystery, where your life enters the life of your beloved, and the beloved's life enters yours. Your life enters into the beloved's, and the beloved enters into you. There's that panentheism again. The love flows through you, as you, it's not you. We did our generational healing this Wednesday. I absolutely love when we do that. And every time we do that, I go deeper and deeper into this kind of unveiling of the illusions. You know, in the egoic mind, which we all have, that beautiful, innocent little egoic mind, it has three aspects to it, Laura. The first aspect is the fixer, or you might call the one who is the manager. He's always managing everything and everyone, and that's the ego's job. The second is the firefighter. He's going to take on those challenges and rectify them. And the third aspect of the ego, which Jeff Foster is a master at, and that's why I chose to do true meditation, he said, are all the exiled ones. All those parts of us that we've shoved down in here that want to come up into the wholeness, into the oneness, to be seen, to be heard, not to be discounted and saying, oh, you're wrong, you're not acceptable, you're flawed. No, to be loved just like a child would come up. And when a child comes up or a little pug comes up and wants to be loved, you love them just where they show up in your life. Oh, several of you have asked about Humphrey, and it is a frickin' miracle, this little dog. He was paralyzed from the neck down for 3.5 days. I didn't think he would come back. He couldn't eat. I'd have to hand feed him food. He couldn't drink. I would squirt it in through a syringe in his mouth. And they did the surgery on his cervical neck, his neck, and they said it would be 6 weeks before he could walk, but on day 4, he stood up. because he was determined. And then he fell over, and then he stood up again, and he staggered to his bed like a drunken sailor. But you know what? It's kind of cute. So we carry him out to the back. He couldn't do his business, but he managed, if you placed him down, he would stagger around the garden. And he can't lift his legs, but he can squat like a little girl, and he does his little pee thing. But the poop position was really difficult. He kept getting in the position and falling over. And I should have taken videos, because I could probably get it on the funniest videos. And you know what? He never complained an inch. What a great guru he has been for me. Whereas my mind was freaking out. What can I do? How can I fix it? How can I save this guy? He was just fine. I saw the power, the miracle of life to reclaim itself, restore itself. And truly, it was miraculous. I was speaking to a dear friend who lost their partner to cancer, and they went through a very long process of this person dying. And they said, I don't think I can get into a relationship again because I don't think I could go through the heartbreak. And I had just been through this with Humphrey, and I said, you know what? I would go through it again and again and again because I could bear it. Someone posted on Facebook this thing by Ram Dass about the unbearable. And sometimes you say it's absolutely unbearable. It was really unbearable for me, holding him in my arms for 3.5 days when I couldn't sleep, I couldn't eat. I didn't know if he was going to survive the night. He would whimper. But you know what? I did bear it. I did bear the unbearable. So the thought that I can't do it was an erroneous thought. There's something that could bear anything. It's not me. So in these generational healings, what I find so refreshing is I've had to play the father now, I think, half a dozen times. And boy, is it healing my father issues. You know, I realize every time I step into the role of the father, my dad did the very best he could with what he had. He didn't have a whole lot of equipment there. He hadn't been loved. How could he give me the love that he didn't have to give? I saw relationships playing out in the generational healing and how the mother wanted something from the father that the father couldn't give. And I saw my own mother wanting something from my dad that he couldn't give, and she expected him to be the generator of it. So every time we go into these direct experiences, something is liberated. Maybe it's the soul, because the ego wants to be in control. Anybody want to be in control out there? That's all your ego. Your mind wants to understand. Anybody want to understand everything? That's your mind. Your soul wants to find meaning in it. So once we make that existential shift from the mind and the ego to the soul and the presence, which is what we are, then we see things differently. And Gigi gave a beautiful birthday card to Trey, and in it she quoted Henry David Thoreau, and it says, the question isn't what you're looking at, but what you see. So what might appearance-wise look like a horrible something that none of us wants to deal with, when you really see it with softer eyes, with compassionate, merciful, someone used the word mercy today, you begin to see, what if this very thing that I thought was unbearable was the very thing that my soul needed in order for it to unfold and open? You know, I wouldn't give anything for those 5 years that I went through in Atlanta with the AIDS crisis. And when I moved to Huntsville, they had the AIDS quilt here, and they brought it, and it filled up a room maybe this size. And all these young men, and I'm sure women too, who had died, made their little patchwork. And I'm walking around this quilt, and everybody's walking around with a can of Kleenex, a box of Kleenex here. And everybody's sobbing, and I didn't have one tear. I had been through so many deaths. I think I had cried myself out. I couldn't feel it. And then when my mother died, I didn't cry then. It was only during a process where they were going to end one organization and open another, and through a ritual, they said, let all the ungrieved grief come up. There was so much grief in me that I didn't think I could ever find my center again. That's the power of repression. We're all so very, very good at that, because it's painful to feel, it's almost unbearable to feel a grief that's much bigger than you. And so, yeah, so every time we do those generational healings, another layer comes off. And Glory G gave me an absolutely huge thing when this woman who was there for a first generational healing had issues with her mother. And she, at the end of that, she asked the woman to speak to her mother as if she were in a chair and have this dialogue with the mother, then sit in the chair next to her, the invisible mother who's not really there. And there was this little bit of separation, so you weren't entangled again in a feeling that was overwhelming. And at the same time, bow to the idea of her, but I don't need you inside me. I don't need your fears, your phobias. My mother was a very fearful woman. And she had fear of heights. Every time I go through this height thing, I feel my mother there. She was just terrified of heights, and she passed that on to me. It's lovely. My father was a race car driver. He would speed and tailgate, and my mother would grip the sides of the car, and all of us children would feel her fear. When my husband decides to tailgate people and go, I feel my mother's in there. She's cringing, just like my... They transmit themselves. They live in you. But when you have an awareness around that, there is an ability to see things with new eyes. That's the mystery. Life gives us everything we need in advance of our asking. And sometimes the very stuff we need is truly unbearable until it is bearable. Huh. Sometimes we call life a struggle until it isn't a struggle. And then you realize that it was never a struggle. It was the struggler I was experiencing. When you change the way you look at things, the things you look at change. So what if we could get to a place where we don't have to struggle with life? We don't have to struggle to understand everything with our mind, but we can find meaning in the smallest of things. I was sharing with the class on Wednesday. We were finishing up the Richard Rohr class, and he gives these beautiful little, he calls them prompts and practices in life. How, like, for instance, I mentioned last week, you can watch your mind and notice that in this mind stream, there are thoughts, and thoughts are like boats. Like the coronavirus would be a boat. We can get in that boat and we can worry and we can fret. Is it coming to Huntsville? It's in Washington now, you know. Or we can just observe the coronavirus boat in the mind. We can observe the election, Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden and Donald Trump. We can observe the boats. We can jump in and we can have a really political conversation. Or we can be the witness, the observer of the mystery of all of that and choose which boat we're going to jump into. I choose to jump into the boats that are life expansive. I was talking to Adam this morning. We were talking about the beauty of relationships. And you know, all of this life is relational. We're dealing in relationships, relationship with self, relationship with seeming other. And how skillful are we at that? I love my wedding vows. Lisa Ferraro asked for a copy of my vows, and she did a wedding while she was in California, and it was at a women's conference. The head of the conference, it was a lesbian conference, she asked Lisa if she would do the same wedding for all the women at this conference where they would marry themselves. Because part of the wedding vow is what you say to your partner, Judy and Hank, one of the first weddings I did, I will honor you, I will respect you, and I will keep inviolate the integrity of your soul. Do we love each other enough to honor the other person, whatever that person might require? If it's to go off into the forest and meditate in a tree, could we honor that? Trey has this thing about gambling at casinos. And every time we go someplace, he makes sure that there's a casino next door. And every day at 4 o'clock, he goes and he plays the slot machines. You know what? It's what he does. It sets his soul free. He has his favorites. He likes the Titanic for whatever reason. I've never gambled. I've never put one nickel in a slot. But you know what? I honor and respect him. And if his soul needs to play the slots, you go for it. So that's part of the beauty of being in relationships. She'll play with him. So the universe is calling. Are you listening? Adam reminded me this morning he got up at 5:30 and he was talking to a crow. And as you were speaking, Adam, I was lying in bed this morning at about 5:45, and all of a sudden a mockingbird was singing outside my window. They're our version of the nightingale, a song that was so incredibly beautiful. And I found myself in between the silence of that beautiful early morning and the song of the mockingbird. I was working at a French restaurant in Atlanta, and Trey came to pick me up. It was on a Saturday night, and the parking lot was packed. And there were these baby mockingbirds hopping around the parking lot. And one of them had gotten squished, so there were two left. And so, being codependent that I am, I scooped up the two baby mockingbirds and rescued them from that parking lot. And I called them George and Gracie. And I brought George and Gracie home, put them in a box. Gracie died of crib death 2 days later, but George managed to survive, and I raised my own little mockingbird. And when George got to be big enough, I recognized that George had needed to leave the nest. He could no longer stay in the nest, and so I took him out, but he didn't want to go. And so finally, George flew up to the highest point in the tree, and then he stood up there and went, beep, beep, that was my cue to feed him, beep. Beep. I said, George, you're going to have to come down. I can't climb the tree to feed you. But George finally did figure out how to come down one last time. And I ran out. Trey said, Eureka, he came out. You feed him wet dog food. You put it on your finger and they eat it. And so Trey had the dog food and we put the finger out and George ate. And he basically said, thanks, guys, but I'm out of here. And George took off, and I never saw him again. So every time I hear a mockingbird, George, is that you? Did you come back to Daddy to let me know you're okay? Because, see, we're all connected. Could we listen to the smallest of things and know that that is really sacred stuff for us? Everything's relational. And for me, my sanctuary is my garden. And we've lived in this house 25 years now, and we had some huge, we still have some huge old trees. One is Hermione in the backyard, and then Lucy's in the front. The other three girls have since passed, you know. But I planted a lot of other trees. And in this little book called The Gardener, by a Spanish author named Grun, he talks about the God chants. And that's the title of today's talk, The God Chants. How God is always chanting. And this is how the little book describes it. It'd be nice if I didn't have to do this with Mike. Anyway. He says, unsurprisingly, the neighbor found the gardener to be somewhat strange. Now, I don't know why they would say that. Maybe because he's talking to birds and trees. And he says, often, he said, you would see the gardener talking to his plants. He would be stroking them and treating them with great affection. And yet he gained no benefit from them in terms of money or success. And his people found that even stranger. Why in the world would he be talking to the plants? So why do you, one of the people asked, why do you stroke your plants and talk to them when they cannot feel your hand or even hear you, said one of his neighbors to him. And the gardener says, well, how do you know that they cannot feel or hear me, he asks, replied the gardener. And the neighbor just looked puzzled. Well, he said, everybody knows that plants are not able to dot, 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 dot. And he says, nor do most men, this is the gardener's response, nor do most men or people feel or hear God, interrupted the gardener. Yet God does not stop talking or caring for us because of this. He's asking you to stretch your imagination, your divine imagination, into a direct communication. You know, it's not about having experiences of the divine. It's our capacity to have those experiences. Next week, I'm speaking about the gift of receptivity. So what if we are challenged by life to continually open to the mystery of this dialogue that gets more intimate with every day? That will bring tears to your eyes. God is always seeking our attention. We are the ones that drifted away, and that's what the gardener is saying. How do you know? So he says, nor do most people feel or hear God, interrupted the gardener. Yet God does not stop talking or caring for us because of this. Well, the neighbor felt increasingly confused and irritated and a little troubled by what the gardener was saying. And he says, and how do you know that God exists, asked the neighbor, if you've never heard him. And nor have I felt him caring for me in any way that you speak of. Well, the gardener bowed his head sadly and was silent. And when the neighbor thought that he was not going to be able to answer him, the gardener looked at him kindly in the eyes. And this is what the gardener said. If you ever stop to listen, on a moonlit night, you will only realize that the crickets sing when they keep quiet. It is the silence that warns you of the presence of that hidden life. God has never stopped singing. He has never stopped talking to us and caring for us. It is for that reason that most men do not notice his silent, ubiquitous love. Huh. And he says, if God stopped singing, even if you realized it the very next instant that he was there, it would be too late. And smiling, the gardener added, but do not worry, God will never, never stop singing. So get up at 5:30 and listen to the silence, and then the crow will start speaking to you. He says, then you will never be able to compromise as that God exists. The neighbor answered with a triumphant smile. The gardener started to laugh, and putting his hand on his neighbor's shoulder, he told him, just as it is with the crickets, if you find this internal peace, the silence will reveal to you God's chants. If you find this inner peace, a young man was speaking about living in that peace this morning, if you find that inner peace, the silence will reveal to you God's chants. Huh. if you find the listening mind, if you find the open heart, if you find that connection to all life. I was doing one of the prompts and practices on Wednesday morning for class before I started, and in the prompt it said, right where you are, observe an object. And as I read that, a little ladybug landed on the book where I was reading in the garden. Humphrey's at one side and Bert's on the other, and the ladybug's on the page. It said, now observe this object, but don't create a story around it. Don't think about it. Just be with it. You and that are not separate. And so I'm sitting there thinking the ladybug chose to land on the book right there, and I'm experiencing my oneness with this ladybug. She was cute, you know, a tiny little thing with the little black dots, and she was red. And when I got to the end of the page, I couldn't turn it over because the ladybug decided not to move. And so I gently lifted up the page and read the other side of it, and then I said, oh, I'll just leave you in the book because you're happy in the book. And then I went around my business with the dogs and all that stuff. And when I came to class later that day, I was sharing with the class, and I opened the book to that passage, and there she is. She'd gotten squished between the pages. And then I had to deal with my own existential guilt about the ladybug, me being overly codependent with this bug. But, you know, that's what life does. I was sharing with this lady. I felt guilty because I put that, we have what they call fire ants, big piles here at the center. And I was working in the garden weeding, and all of a sudden the fire ants went up my arm and they're stinging me. I know. And so I got a little rage. So I got the fire ant stuff and I made a hole in the nest and I poured it in. And then I felt like I was a mercenary, that I was killing all these little life forces. So at Satsang, this lovely lady who's an organic gardener, she lives up in Tennessee, and she said, oh, she's plagued with the fire ants. I said, so how do you deal with it compassionately? She said, I use cornmeal. She says, cornmeal will, they eat it and they, you know, and so I said, well, but it's more organic. I know. So here we're trying to, I know, well, they're fire ants. So then I have to make peace with life and death. And Glory G and I were talking about this woman who was a vegan and a vegetarian her whole life. And she was out working in the garden one morning, and she realized that the tomatoes and the turnips and the radishes all have that same experience that a pig would have or a chicken would have, because it's life feeding on life. So what if we knew, and you know, in that beautiful Hindu symbology of Kali, the mother of creation, she's giving birth to creation and eating the creation at the same time. Life lives off life. It's just the way it is. That little ladybug is a cannibal. She eats the aphids right in the plants. You put the ladybugs in the plants, and she's going around eating. So it's just the mind that creates a narrative, a story, and then the mind wants to fix it or understand it or somehow struggle with it until you don't struggle anymore. Until you don't struggle. So in my non-struggling, I tried to find a practice for you guys that would be meaningful. And it's from Anthony DeMillo's little book called Wellsprings. And it's so funny because we just finished a book, Richard Rohr, Franciscan monk. John O'Donohue was a monk for 19 years. He left the monastery. And Anthony DeMillo is a Jesuit monk. Now, what they all have in common was they withdrew from the world and they found this direct experience with presence. Then they came back to the world to offer their gift. And they said, it's not enough to have a direct experience. The capacity for that experience needs to expand. And so this is Anthony DeMillo expanding his idea of listening to God, which is speaking everywhere. There's an Ojibwe prayer that we do in our at Circle of Love when we do our Taizé service that I try to bring with us every time because it's so powerful. And in the Ojibwe prayer, we say to the trees, teach us and show us the way. We say to the humble weed by the garden wall, teach us and show us the way. We say to the ladybug who lands on your book, teach us and show us the way. We talk to a little pug who can't move his limbs, Humphrey, teach us and show us the way. We talk to the old Bert who thought his job was to take care of Humphrey. Bert, teach us and show us the way. And you know they do if you have the capacity to experience their wisdom. You know what I love so much about Bert is he thought his job was to take care of Humphrey. And when Humphrey was paralyzed and I put him in his bed, Bert unconsciously or consciously curled up on top of him like a mother would. So I had to scoop Humphrey out from under Bert, and I placed Humphrey on the pee pad. And then Bert, in his well-meaningness, got out of the bed and curled up next to Humphrey on the pee pad. Now, the pee pad was the size for one dog, but Bert managed to squeeze his side in right there next to Humphrey. Now that someone loaned us a stroller, Humphrey, in his royalty, because, you know, pugs are royal in the Chinese dynasty, he sits in that stroller like he is regal. And Bert is so happy, but he's confused. So Bert walks right next to the stroller, and he keeps licking his ears and licking his face, because now Humphrey's traveling on a Cadillac and Bert's prancing right next to him. Teach us and show us the way. So this is Anthony DeMillo. He says, I become conscious of my breathing or of the sensations in my body, for this will give me silence. Now, Glory G, this Wednesday night, she's going to talk about the wisdom of the body. The body never lies. Could we actually listen to the wisdom of the body, and by going within, experience the silence in there? It gives us silence because you've moved out of your head. You're no longer in that narrative going on and trying to understand and think. You're actually resting as resting. And, you know, Jeff's book right before the true meditation was The Way of Rest, to just rest in the sounds of silence. So that's what he's saying. And God's revealing word is only understood, he says, in the silence. So here's how he approaches it. He says, I look at nature, which is all around me, the trees, the birds, the animals, the sky, and this gentle earth. And I think of nature in her varying moods, in the freshness of the morning, with the crow and the mockingbird singing, in the heat of the afternoon. People say, you've been out in the sun. I've been weeding the garden. That's what it looks like. I don't lie in the sun anymore. I did when I was young. Now I get out there and weed the garden and get a glorious tan. In the heat of the afternoon, at sunset, when the sky turns pink, and at the dead of night, he said, I see her especially in her constant movement, in the ever-changing seasons of the year, in the rise and fall of life and death, and her beauty and her violence. There's a hawk that lives in our neighborhood, and he's so majestic, and every now and then I see him swoop down to the bird feeders and get a pigeon or a mourning dove and take him up to the tree, and I find there's peace in that. The hawk has to survive too, you know, my little codependent mind lets go of that. And I ask, what are you saying to me through nature, oh my Lord, oh my God? What are you saying to me through nature? Gigi and I were talking about how we misinterpreted Genesis when it says man shall have dominion over the earth. Didn't mean we're there to rape it and pillage it. It meant we're here to hold it sacred, that we're here to be stewards of it. Boy, it would be different, wouldn't he? And he said, and I ask, what are you saying to me through nature, O Lord? What message are you giving me? And then I look at her, and I wait for God to reply. And it may come in a word, it may come in a sentence, it may come in an image, or a silence that instructs my heart beyond all words. Could we listen and discover what is it? Teach me and show us the way. And then really listen. Get your journal out. Draw it. You're creative beings. Let the divine imagination operate on you. John O'Donohue, right shortly before his death, prematurely at 52, he was being interviewed by the Irish radio, and I listened to that interview, and they asked him about the Celtic way and how it's so linked to the shamanic way, where nature is so revelatory. And he said, I think because, he says, you know, I lived in Ireland, he said, in Connemara, he says, you had the rugged cliffs that were millions of years old, and then you had the rugged shoreline and the ocean right there. And he says, there's something when you live around the mystery like that, it contagions you with its beauty, because it's so vast, so mysterious, that you can't let your intellect think it's got all the answers. So he said, if it fails to come, I ask the tree to tell me, or I'll ask the birds or the stars or the rivers, what part of nature I happen to be looking at. And he says, I look at human history whenever I recall, whatever I recall of it, from the Stone Age to our times, and the rise and the fall of nations and of cultures, of peace and war, peoples, good and bad. And as I look, I wait again for this divine word to speak to me in the silence. You know, when you've lived as long as I have and you've seen the evolution of consciousness, you know, we started off as, I think it was Homo Neanderthal, and then we went to Homo erectus, and then we went to Homo sapiens sapien, and now we're evolving into Homo universalis. What if, when we look at history, we can see how far we've come? We no longer need a nest of a limited doctrine or dogma, but an expansive spirituality that comes from within. So in the shamanic tradition, they say all your answers are within you. They're not in some scripture. They're not in some priest. They're all within you. Could we go within and be informed, formed from within, which is the kingdom of heaven, which is what Jesus talked about, and to discover that for the first time? So he's saying the same thing. And as I look, I wait again and let this word speak to me in the silence. And through each of the persons that I'm living with, God breaks into my life. What is he doing? What is he saying through them? Huh. Have you ever thought of your relationship as a divine one, where you're actually in this on purpose, not to change or fix them, but to honor them where they are? I honor you, I respect you, and I keep inviolate the integrity of your process. When I was working in the AIDS crisis, and there was this young man who was not dying, and his partner was very uncomfortable, and the hospice nurse said to the one who was uncomfortable, you need to honor the one who's dying's process. Let him die in his own way. And it spoke volumes to me. Could we honor each other's process, knowing that everyone is doing the very best they can with what they have? He says, so through each person I'm living with, I ask the universe to assist me in knowing what I need to know in that moment. He says, I am grateful not to rush to put it into words. I wait until the answer is given in a language that is most often in silence. Huh. I do the same with life events, the joyful ones, the painful ones, the sensational ones, and the day-to-day events. There's not a good moment and a bad moment. They're just moments. And could I know in those really tough moments, as Kim did, in 5 minutes, I can shift the way I'm going to respond. I can start off in reaction, and then just by a little inquiry, I can step into that heart space, and I've shifted. That's the whole purpose of what we do here, is to take dominion over the dream that we're creating. So he says, the number is too large. I could choose to merely see what happened yesterday or today, far from the moment that I awoke in. And even while I sleep, God has never ceased to act or to reveal itself. One of my students in the day class had one of those dreams that she knew was a numinous dream. And in this dream, and while she was dreaming it, it was a lucid dream, and she found herself crawling up into a house, which house represents your consciousness, from the back, climbing over this railing, entering into the house, and there were three strange women in her house, and she said, you all need to leave. Profound dream. She decided she's no longer going to live with her own committee, the nattering nabobs of negativity that take residence in your consciousness, because she took dominion over her consciousness, and her dream was showing that. So she shared that with us in the class. So I search, hoping that my eyes will see and that my heart will understand. Or I ask the event itself, please speak to me and help me understand. And I've gotten past the idea that I have to understand. I says, please show me the meaning in this. How can I find the grace in this? How can I surrender my need to fix it? That was my big thing with Humphrey. I wanted to fix it and control it, and I had no control, and I couldn't fix it. But could I surrender to the grace of it and know that it was working on me? So that little pug has given me such grace. He says, before I end, I pray, and that the Lord will give me light to always help me understand. I would add, to help me find the meaning in this. He says, for scriptures that he writes today, my life and every single thing around me teaches me and shows me the way. My life and every single thing around me teaches me and shows me the way. So I'm going to ask you to take communion with your life, communion with a ladybug, communion with a tree. There was a lady in my class, she said she loves trees, and she stands up against them, and she feels the heart of the tree connecting to the heart of her. Is the lady crazy? I don't know. I think it's kind of beautiful to stand back to back with a tree and to let the tree offer its wisdom. Could we listen then when it starts to happen? Not for a necessarily logical answer, but for a heartfelt connectedness and a sense of meaning. So I'm going to invite you to just be still. Huh. And in that stillness, feel or find the peace that's right here, right now. Jesus called it the peace that passeth all understanding. Huh. We don't have to understand it. It's just there right now. And to be immersed in that peace is the greatest wealth any of us can find. So when the world is frightened out there in the world around a coronavirus or around God knows what else, guns, there is this peace. And when we find that peace, we're no longer clinging to our ideas that I'm here to save the world. I don't have to struggle or fix anything. I'm just in that peaceful place observing the world. The world isn't a problem to be fixed. It's an opportunity to be seen and heard and loved, just as it is. So we create a holding space right now in that silence, in that open-hearted awareness, where we can hold the confusion, where we can hold the suffering on the planet. Just hold them in that peace. We're not in the mindset that wants to fix it anymore. We're in that open-hearted place that Remy sang about. You are the heart of spirit on earth. And who you are and what you do is a blessing to the world. So we change the world one heart at a time by offering our heart as that holding space. And when the mind is confused, we take that confused mind. We get curious about it. What are you showing me? When there is a pattern of struggle and effort and suffering, we ask that suffering and that message from the body or the emotions, what are you showing me? And then through lowly listening, we discover, huh. And as we start hearing with this softer receptivity within our heart, the very thing that was holding us stops grasping at us and kind of releases itself, and we're free. We're free in the soul to discover and experience all of life, no longer choosing the good over the bad, but knowing that there is no good or bad, but thinking makes it so. And so life gives us these beautiful growth experiences. Huh? And we say yes to them, 1,000 times yes. Ashley reminded me that she left church last Sunday saying, yes, yes, 1,000 times yes. And life will give us everything we need. And so we say yes to it. Yes to the confusion. Yes to the clarity. Yes to the chaos. Yes to the peace. Yes to the fear. Yes to the hurt. Yes to the joy. And it all finds an equanimity in this beautiful held space. This is truly meditation. What true meditation is to embrace what is with a jubilant and beholden heart, as Emerson would say. A jubilant and beholden heart is a grateful heart. To be grateful for all of it. It may be coming to clear us out, to move us forward, to move us deeper in. And so it is all truly a blessing. In the silence, we can hear God's chants. And so if you are up to this task today, I invite you to move in silence and to listen as this divine presence speaks to you in your own unique way, from within your heart, from within your soul. And just like the crazy gardener who talked to his plants, could you know that God has never stopped speaking, has never stopped loving you. And in this holy instant, we feel that presence. It's so simple and yet so profound. So with gratitude and a willingness to open our eyes, to lift our hands in the air, to shake your little feathers. See, it's that little participatory thing. The soul loves that. And so it is.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. For more information, please visit www.cslhuntsville.org. To create a brand new world.